You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
A new ad campaign on the way to screens, ballot papers on their way to letterboxes, and the same-sex marriage debate, finally, on its way to a result.
You'll be asked to answer one question. Choose either yes or no on the form.
Australia's ongoing attempt to demonstrate how torturous, undignified and ridiculous a country can possibly make the process of extending basic civil rights to all of its citizens. My guests Terry Stiassny and Ivor Gaber will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Turkey's reasons for ditching the NATO brochure as it goes missile shopping, President Emmanuel Macron's interesting strategy of characterising opponents of labour law reform as bone-idle shirkers, and the life and legacy of Peter Hall. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Terry Stiassny, the author and journalist, and Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex. Welcome both to the programme. We will start today with Turkey, which at several points in recent years has prompted its fellow members of NATO to ponder the seriousness of Turkey's commitment to the alliance. Those questions will be asked with renewed urgency following the news that Turkey is to spend $2.5 billion buying missiles from Russia, the country that NATO is largely a guarantor against. Turkey, wielder of NATO's second largest military, is to buy the Russian S-400 anti-aircraft missile. Terry, first of all, NATO members are encouraged, for obvious enough reasons, to buy, you know, systems which are actually compatible with others used by the alliance. There are some Warsaw Pact armies which do still have some antique Soviet-built kit, but this is weird. Why is Turkey doing this?
It is quite weird. I can only think that in the bigger picture that it's a sign of Erdogan trying to draw closer to Putin. You know, if you're going to go and order $2 billion worth and you just put down the deposit on your $2 billion worth of S-400 anti-aircraft missiles, this helps to cement the friendship. I guess it comes against the background of the German elections, where they're suggesting during the campaign that Turkey's membership of the EU is sort of on the back burner. You know, even further, a further back burner.
I think it's
like,
a long
way
back from the back burner. Yeah. It's somewhere in the front yard at this point.
I think it's a really worrying development. If you're, you have the strange situation that you will have Russia has these same anti-aircraft missiles at its bases in Syria, pointing in one direction, and Turkey might possibly have them pointing in the other direction. And the fact being that Turkey would quite like to use these against Kurdish people on whichever side of the border.
Ivor, is this actually Turkey filling a strategic need by buying this missiles, or is this Turkey spending a vast sack of cash in order to say yah, boo, sucks to NATO after the US and Germany withdrew their Patriot air defences from Turkey?
Well, there's a soupçon of strategic calculation in this. That what do Turkey and Russia have in common, or Erdogan and Putin, is a stance against America. Particularly for Putin, for obvious reasons, but you know, Turkey is still very angry about the alleged failure of the US to extradite Gulen, who they blame for all their woes. So I think there's a very strong anti-American flavour to this. But of course, when you look at their attitudes to Assad, it's a little contradictory, because Russia is an enthusiastic supporter and Turkey's not. So what happens, and I don't know the answer, if Turkey engages Assad's army with these missiles? Will the similar Russian missiles shoot down the identical Turkish missiles whilst Assad looks on? It's bizarre, to say the least. Whether they'll actually take delivery, of course, depends on whether this strategic alliance, very tenuous alliance between Turkey and Russia, holds. I don't think it will for the long term.
Terry, you mentioned Turkey's theoretical application to join the EU. I don't think any sane person believes that this is going to happen sooner than Turkey, for example, puts a man on Mars.
The Leave campaign in the UK said it was just around the corner.
No, the Leave campaign said that the entire population of Diyarbakir would move in next door to your house if you voted Remain. Words to that effect. But Terry, they are, though they're never going to join the EU, they are a member in good standing in theory of NATO, as I pointed
Absolutely,
out, you're owner of NATO's second largest military. Is NATO still being naive at this point in thinking of Turkey, if not necessarily as a member, then certainly as a meaningful ally?
Well, I think there are going to be a lot of questions. I mean, it's surprising, having looked around, I haven't seen that much sort of open public reaction from either NATO or NATO members saying, excuse me, what are you doing right now? But I suppose there are all these questions of is it just Turkey that commands and controls these? What are other people able to do, other countries within NATO, to say when they can actually use them? Can Turkey just go ahead and use it? If Turkey gets embroiled in skirmishes on the borders, are we then bound to kind of join in? I mean, we've had sort of semi-detached members of NATO in the past, but you probably don't want one right on these very edges where you've got so many conflicts going on.
Turkey's membership of NATO has always been problematic, given that on the one hand, it's had that crucial role of the front line with the Cold War, when it had the closest missiles to Russia, to the Soviet Union, and therefore was valuable. On the other hand, it's the only NATO member that's declared war on another NATO member and remains, i.e. Greece, and invaded Cyprus and remains occupying Greek territory. So this is a very dubious is perhaps the wrong word, but a fragile member of the alliance.
Yeah. And I imagine if you were, say, a Baltic state, for example, you wouldn't be best pleased about this at all, you know, seeing other members of NATO deciding to buy the kind of Russian missiles that you're precisely worried about.
Well, indeed not. But let's look now at France, where President Emmanuel Macron is beginning to grasp the consequences of seizing the third rail of French politics. The country's labour laws, which make the dismissal of employees infamously difficult, even if, to quote a completely random example, they appear congenitally incapable of loading your checked luggage onto the same plane on which you are flying. Demonstrations have taken place in Paris, Lyon, Marseille and other big cities and seem unlikely to be the last. First of all, we should take the wider view than my own unfortunate experiences with Air France over the years. But seriously, their record on this is extraordinary. How necessary are the reforms, really?
I think that on the one hand, if you look at the French economy, and it's had much higher unemployment rates than other major EU countries, i.e. Germany, Italy and UK and Spain, persistently higher. And as you say, one of the reasons is that the immobility of labour. They don't have the flexibility of labour. They can't move it around. And yet, at the same time, French productivity has remained persistently high. So here you've got the paradox, and the staunch trade unionists would say, there you are, because we're protected, we're more productive. And therefore, messing around with the labour laws, you mess with them at the peril, because we'll end up deregulated and miserable, like our British colleagues, who have the lowest productivity amongst the major EU nations, and therefore strong, protected workers are happy workers. And so, Mr. Macron, you're making a big mistake, they would say.
On the subject of the unions, though, Terry, there is this conventional wisdom that the French unions are this terrifying, all-powerful leviathan that you cross at your very great risk. But only 11% of French workers actually belong to a trade union now, and I'm not saying that like it's a good thing. Two of the biggest unions, the CFDT and the FO, are not attending these protests. Should Macron actually hold his nerve here? Have his predecessors perhaps been a bit too scared of the unions?
I think he should. This is basically the platform that he came in on. He's been coming and telling sort of French workers, you've gone over to London, people who want to start up businesses, people running small firms, we're going to change things and make it easier for you to hire and fire people. And also making the point that, you know, if you're not one of the members of a trade union, if you're one of the unemployed, if you're not in a big union, the French economy is not necessarily going to work for you. And also, as you say, whether you've been in an Air France baggage handler or a cafe that hasn't got enough staff, it is hard to hire people in France, and it's hard to get rid of them if things don't work out. And I think the fact that, you know, these protests aren't as big as some of the ones we've seen, I mean, this is a French tradition, it does happen every autumn, like the rentrée, like back to school, you have the autumn chaud, the hot autumn, where everybody goes on strike and they throw things out of windows and they blockade the motorways. It does happen all the time, but if you haven't got the biggest unions joining in, it's not as big as we might think it is.
I mean, everybody should get tear gassed in Paris at least once. As indeed have I. But you haven't really been there unless that's happened.
Well, I mean, there is a French romantic tradition going back to the revolution, the sans-culottes and so forth, to the streets. But I do think Terry's right, this is not looking like 1968 all over again, with the biggest union not taking part and a union that's actually regarded to the left of CGT sitting on its hands. I think they've got their work cut out. However, if you look at the opposition to Hollande, that the unions built up to Hollande, it started small and got very, very big, and in the end really did for Hollande. So we write them off at our peril.
Just on from the perspective of political messaging, Ivor, what do you make of Macron's take in describing his opponents as slackers, cynics and hardliners?
Well, I think some would say that's telling it like it is. I mean, Macron has risen fast and fallen even faster in one sense. He was a brilliant political messenger during the election campaign, and then subsequently, both in terms of what he's been saying and how he's been presenting himself, he's bombed. And I think this is an example that he lacks political experience. That is a way, if you want to get people out on the streets, then start calling the workers' names. So I think that was foolish.
Ivan makes a reasonable point there, Terry, that President Macron's popularity ratings have tanked sensationally since the day after he was sworn in. Does he have the political capital left to fight and win a big battle like this one?
I think he still has. I mean, one of the other things is, you know, again, he's not really taking on the public sector workers yet. He's mostly changing these rules for the private sector to start with. He's not going for that. He's also, it'll be interesting to see whether this works out today. He's not in France. He's gone to Saint-Martin to go and help the relief effort in the Caribbean, or, you know, look cool and go on a boat or whatever he does. You know, he does like a big photo op. And sometimes, as Ivor says, that backfires on him when he's seen, you know, going through the Palace of Versailles, or where he sort of looks like he's driving a submarine. So I think he could still, if he holds to it and uses a bit of political smarts, he's bringing this all in by decree, which has also caused a bit of controversy, because he's trying to do it fast and not through a slow legislative process. But yeah, I think he's got to sort of hang on in there.
Has he effectively already bet his presidency on this, Ivor?
I mean, we're talking a long time ahead, and anybody who makes political predictions these days don't know what they're talking about. But at the risk, I think he has to some extent. It's become a symbolic issue. It was a symbolic issue for Sarkozy as well as Hollande. The last two French presidents, I think, have been undone, lost credibility by their failure. They both made a big issue of reforming French labour laws. They both were seen to fail in a very obvious way. So I think he has, although we're talking, he's got 6.5 years in office, goodness me. Who would make predictions except a foolish person like myself? I think he's gone big.
Just a final thought on this one, Terry. Is there anything that Macron can usefully learn from the failures of his predecessors in dealing with this?
I think, well, perhaps this is the reason that he's trying to do it through this sort of slightly backdoor approach of reforming the legal code, rather than, you know, trying to make a big play of, say, changing the law through a rather slow process. So maybe he hopes that, you know, once he's actually got this done, then that will take some of the heat out of it. And maybe just repeating this idea that, you know, this is what he came in, this is what he was elected to do, and, you know, try and make it look a bit more...
The other thing I wonder, and I don't know because I haven't spoken to him, is to what extent this is relates to his relations with Merkel, that he's concerned that if and when she wins the German elections, she will bestride Europe like no other. And he wants to demonstrate that he is as big or almost as big a figure as she. And by starting this battle and sort of laying it down as a marque event, he's hoping to reassert France's role within the EU and its relationship with Germany. Just a thought.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Terry Stiassny and Ivor Gaber. Coming up next, why is Australia insisting on doing the decent thing by the dumbest means possible?
Visit our online shop, where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or, if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we will take care of you personally. See you around.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Mullister. With me are Terry Stiassny and Ivor Gaber. Let's look now at Australia, where my fellow citizens thereof are now in receipt of their ballot papers for the current postal plebiscite, easy for me to say, on whether or not Australia should get around to extending the right to marry to its gay citizens. It has been pointed out and is about to be pointed out again that this seems to be an unnecessarily complicated means of going about what seems a straightforward enough proposition in a country where polls put approval of gay marriage at around 70%. I will just now plug this weekend's edition of The Foreign Desk, in which we will be taking a long and probably even more exasperated look at this. Terry, how hard can this possibly be, and why is my homeland trying to make this so difficult? Please.
Yeah, you're probably a better place to answer
please,
that than me.
No, because I don't understand this at all.
It does seem strange to have, you know, we've had all the arguments here in Britain about, you know, how binding is even a properly constituted referendum. And this just seems like a send in your opinion on a postcard and we may or may not take it into account. And we think we know what you think anyway.
Depressingly, you have literally exactly summed it up.
But hasn't the government given a commitment that they will introduce legislation, although they haven't quite said in what form, if the vote goes in favour of reform?
My only response to this, and I do need to think of a better one before we record this week's edition of The Foreign Desk, is sort of protracted, exasperated sighing. I would have assumed many years ago that Australia would have been one of the first countries in the world to get out in front of this.
Let me try another explanation, which
please.
Is Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister, inherited a very... trying to avoid political bias, a very discredited party that Tony Abbott had led into the Stone Ages.
He tried, certainly.
As Mrs. May, many years ago, tried to disinfect the Tory party, who she said are known as the nasty party, by her and David Cameron introducing progressive social legislation, including gay marriage. I wonder if Malcolm Turnbull is thinking he'll pull off the same trick, because he's got a majority, I think, of one, and the next election is probably not looking good for him. So maybe he's trying to attract the more socially liberal members who didn't like the way that the Liberal Party turned out, or has been turning out under Abbott.
I mean, Terry, at this point... should it not be clear to not just Australia, but to any country still thinking about this, that I think we're up to now 24 countries around the world which have legalised gay marriage to some extent or another. In some places, it's only legal in some parts. In some places, there aren't adoption rights. But let's call it 24 countries. Not one of those has been picked clean by a plague of locusts.
Yet.
I mean, as you say, you know, this seems to be something that's not, you know, obviously it's controversial among some people, but the vast majority of Australians, from what I've read, seem to support the idea. But it just seems to be one of those, you know, the trouble with any kind of referendum, plebiscite, whatever we're going to call it, is that people start dragging in other issues. So it's not just the issue of gay marriage, which obviously many people seem to be in favour of, but then people seem to say, oh, well, you know, it's going to affect sex education and it's going to affect, you know, what colour clothes you can buy your children. And so the danger is that people who are sort of socially conservative start lumping all of these other issues values in as well.
Which, people, you know, have literally made, people have literally made dumber arguments than that on the no side. My favourite one so far, and this was an actual grown adult human male, spoke in front of his people on television and said that if gay marriage was to become legal in Australia, then people, upon learning that he was married, might not instantly assume it was to a woman.
Well, breaking out of this politically correct circle, I think I can understand why some people would regard this as an important issue. Certainly my understanding of what's going on in Australia, that the phone-ins, which are not necessarily representative, are loud with the cries of no, 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 this is the end of civilisation as we know.
But aren't phone-ins always?
Sometimes.
I mean, it's the same law of newspaper comment sections, that the trouble with radio phone-ins is that they're dominated by the kind of people who call radio phone-ins.
That, I'm just writing an article suggesting that's changing, but I'll leave that for the moment. But just to come back to the issue, I do think that if you are a committed Christian or Muslim for that matter, you would find this quite a difficult issue. And there are many people who are strong adherents to their religion. Tim Farron, for example, who was leader of the Liberal Democrats in this country until recently, for them it's a difficult issue. And so I do think we have to recognise that there is a strong body of opinion that regards this as a matter of morality and conviction.
Except there were strong bodies of opinion that regarded interracial marriage as a matter of morality and conviction as well. Are we obliged to take that seriously?
Well, we're obliged to take it seriously. We don't have to agree with it. We have to demonstrate they're wrong. But in this issue, I don't think everybody who is opposed to gay marriage, and let me say I am not opposed to gay marriage, but I don't think we can write off everybody who's opposed to gay marriage as loony Neanderthals. They are people with strong convictions who we might or might not agree with. No, is that not fair?
I think the interesting thing that David Cameron did in this country was to make it actually a very conservative argument about marriage. He, you know, when he stood up in that party conference probably, 10, 12 years ago now, and said, I believe in marriage, whether it's between a man and a woman, a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, he was kind of saying, well, I like the institution of marriage, which many people up until then had said, well, you know, we don't need that. And he'd sort of made the case to conservatives on that basis, apart from as well on the obvious basis of, if this is a civil thing and this is not through your church or your mosque or whatever, then everybody should have equal rights before the law.
Okay, well, like I said, more on that on the Foreign Desk this Saturday at midday. We should now note the passing, aged 86, of Sir Peter Hall. Sir Peter founded the Royal Shakespeare Company in 1960, was director of the National Theatre and artistic director at Glyndebourne, among many other things. As a legacy, it's probably incalculable, but let's have a crack, shall we? Terry, Sir Peter Hall's influence on British theatre, is it one of those things you could overstate if you tried?
No, I don't think you could. I mean, not only can you imagine, at the age of 29, he founded the Royal Shakespeare Company. He turned the Stratford Theatre into from something that had been an occasional let's have a summer season now again to, you know, the institution that we know. Not only that, when he was 24 in 1955, he did the first English language production of Waiting for Godot. So it wasn't only the classics, it wasn't only Shakespeare, it wasn't only opera, but he premiered sort of 10 Harold Pinter plays. He completely helped to revolutionise British theatre. And I think we kind of forget that because he's been around for so long and was such a grand old man of British theatre that he was pretty radical and challenging in his youth.
I loved the anecdote that when he first produced Waiting for Godot, he said to the actors, well, I haven't got a foggiest what this is all about, but have a crack at it. That is brave. That is very brave.
I mean, also, Terry, as part of his legacy, how important was his staunch lobbying for government funding for the arts? Because this is, again, one of those things that is often taken for granted but shouldn't be.
Yes, I mean, he had an absolutely hellish time when he was trying to set up the National Theatre as we know it now on the South Bank, when it moved from the Old Vic into the great big, you know, concrete blocks on the South Bank. Well, because people weren't really sure about it. And he made himself a massive enemy of Margaret Thatcher, not only because they were putting on quite sort of challenging plays like Romans in Britain, which Mary Whitehouse famously didn't like and tried to sue for blasphemy. But he was making this case for somebody, as somebody who'd come up from a fairly humble background, that the arts were really important, that we needed funding, and that we needed, you know, plays by people like David Hare and the like that, you know, weren't just sort of the things we knew and love.
It's difficult to avoid having a too much of an Anglophile view, but it does seem to me that for the last 20 or 30 years, British theatre has been in a very healthy state. And I think the Royal Shakespeare Company and the National Theatre are the bedrock now. Whether that's, as I say, a view from London and others wouldn't share, I don't know. But I do agree. I think Peter Hall has set out a foundation for a whole generations of directors, playwrights, actors. You mentioned David Hare. There are successes to David Hare writing challenging stuff being shown at the National Theatre as well.
And it was financially successful because he didn't just believe it should be funded. He believed his plays should make money as well. And, you know, you try and get a ticket for the National Theatre now, you see.
Well, finally tonight, we do need to consider the legal precedent established by photographer David Slater, who has settled after a two-year fight for the legal rights to a self-portrait taken with one of his cameras by an Indonesian crested black macaque. Suit was brought against Slater by PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, claiming that the copyright in the much-loved image was in fact owned by the monkey. Ivor, I am a journalist. I have had several rows with various publishers over questions of copyright. It's a weird one because it's very hard to apply hard and fast rules, and people always try and fiddle with it, and they always try to take it off creators, etc., etc., etc. But in this particular case, is it as silly as it sounds? Is there an argument that the copyright in this image was in fact owned by the macaque?
It is 99% silly. Very silly. But there's a 1% issue here. And that is, as it happens, a colleague of mine is currently researching the notion of can we talk about animals, not necessarily macaques, but all animals having consciousness, and what do we understand by consciousness? And the argument would go, if they have consciousness, then they are able to take decisions. And it was the decision by the monkey to press the shutter that allegedly enabled him to have copyright. That's 1%. Please don't hit me, because I think generally it's very stupid. And I think PETA made a reward for themselves, plus the fact the photographer has reportedly said they've got the wrong monkey. But that's a detail. They named the monkey.
That would have been brilliant if somebody else acting for the actual monkey had then brought suit against the first monkey.
For impersonation.
What the thing is well, there are so many issues that are actually extrapolatable from this, though, Terry, especially the one about copyright in the online age. That image went massively viral. It was reprinted and distributed by people who paid neither the photographer nor the monkey a cent for it. Is there any means of policing that? Because the slightly less ridiculous one that I wonder about is people posting images of their children on social media, which is not necessarily a question of copyright, but there is a question of consent.
There is, and my children constantly remind me, and I think they will probably now, having read, if they read this, send me lawyers' letters every time I put a picture of them up on Facebook. It reminds me all a bit of the Inspector Clouseau film where the blind beggar outside the bank robbery says, "No, I'm the musician, the monkey is the businessman." but if the monkey could stand up in court and argue this for himself, I would start to believe that he could have, you know, legal personality and hold copyright. I mean, I know monkeys are smart, monkey lawyers, maybe.
But there is an issue that sometimes comes up in English.
I think I've hired a couple of those for various conveyancing purposes.
It does come up in British courts, though, the issue of people leaving their estate to animals, not necessarily animal charities, which exist, but I'm leaving it to my dog and they need £100,000 to have the care. And these wills have been contested and the animal has the right, so to speak, or the will has to be respected. And so some wretched dog lives a life of luxury. So it's not entirely fantasy, this. The animals do get rights, get their day in court. Woof, woof.
My son did tell me the other day that he wanted to be a human rights lawyer for robots in the future because he reckoned that with artificial intelligence, robots would need representation in a similar way.
I'd have a
to
word
monkeys.
With your son.
I mean, doesn't it seem self-evident that artificial intelligence will create its own lawyers?
Well, yeah, could be, yeah.
I mean, just a final thought on this one, Ivor. Is there a way that photographers should handle this as a matter of conscience, if not of law? Like, if you happen to accidentally allow a monkey to take a self-portrait with your cameras, should you try and cut, you know, the macaque population of the world in on your fortune somehow?
That's a very easy question to answer, Andrew. No, not at all. It is raising a much more important question of how much right. If a photographer takes pictures of you in public and makes a fortune out of it, you particularly doing something silly, Do you have any rights at all? No, you don't.
And that is a separate argument which we do not presently have time to have. Terry Stiassny and Ivor Gaber, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's our weekly design show, Section D, and there's more on the day's big stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 tomorrow, London time. I will be your host for that as well. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening.